This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Last Stop Auschwitz, My Story of Survival from Within the Camp. Written by Eddie DeVint. Translated from Dutch by David Colmer. Read by Robert Fass. In 1943, Jewish doctor Eddie DeVint volunteered to work in Westerbork, a transit camp for the deportation of Jews in the east of the Netherlands. From Westerbork, inmates were sent on to concentration camps, including Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen. Eddie had been told that his mother would be exempted from deportation in exchange for his work. In fact, she had already been sent to Auschwitz. At Westerbork, Eddie met a young Jewish nurse named Friedel. They fell in love and married at the camp. Then, in 1943, they were transported to Auschwitz on a freight train. Unlike so many people arriving at Auschwitz, they were not killed immediately. But they were separated. Eddie ended up in Block 9 as part of the medical staff, Friedel in Block 10, where sterilization and other medical experiments were conducted by doctors, including the notorious Josef Mengele and the gynecologist Karl Klauberg. Somehow, both Eddie and Friedel survived. When the Russians approached Auschwitz in the autumn of 1944, the Nazis tried to cover their tracks. They fled, taking with them many prisoners, including Friedel, who were ordered to walk toward Germany. These walks, which later became known as the Death Marches, were intended to eradicate all evidence of the concentration camp's atrocities. Eddie hid and remained in the camp. It would take months before the war ended. He joined the Russian liberators. By day, he treated the often very ill survivors the Nazis had left behind and the Russian soldiers. In the evenings, having found a pencil and a notebook, he began to write with furious energy about his experiences at Auschwitz. In his traumatized state, he created the character of Hans to be the narrator of his own story. Other than in a few instances, the horror of his experience was still so raw, he couldn't find the words to describe it in the first person. This is Eddie's story. How far is it to those hazy blue mountains? How wide is the plain that stretches out in the radiant spring sunshine? It's a day's march for feet that are free, a single hour on horseback at full trot. For us, it is farther, much farther, infinitely far. Those mountains are not of this world, not of our world, because between us and those mountains is the wire. Our yearning, the wild pounding of our hearts, the blood that rushes to our heads, they are all powerless, because of that wire between us and the plain. Two parallel fences of high-voltage barbed wire with dim red lights that glow above them as a sign that death is lurking there, lying in wait for all of us imprisoned here in this rectangle enclosed by a tall white wall. Always the same image, the same feeling. We stand at the windows of our blocks and look into the enticing distance while our chests heave with tension and impotence. We are 11 yards away from each other. I lean out of the window while longing for that faraway freedom. Friedel can't even do that. Her imprisonment is more complete. I can still move freely through the lager. Friedel can't even do that. I live in Block 9, an ordinary hospital block. Frida lives in Block 10. There are sick people there too, but not like in my block. Where I am, there are people who have fallen ill from cruelty, starvation, and overwork. Those are natural causes that lead to natural diseases that can be diagnosed. Block 10 is the experimental block. The women who live there have been violated by sadists who call themselves professors. Violated in a way that a woman has never been violated before. Violated in the most beautiful thing they possess. Their womanhood. Their ability to become mothers. A girl who is forced to submit to an uncontrolled brute's savage lust suffers too. But the deed she endures springs from life itself, from life's urges. In Block 10, the motive is not an eruption of desire. It is a political delusion, a financial interest. All this we know as we look out over this plain in the south of Poland and long to run through the fields and marshes that separate us from the hazy blue Beskid Mountains on the horizon. But that is not all we know. We also know that for us, there is only one end. Only one way to be free from this barbed wire hell. Death. We know that death can come to us here in different forms. He can come as an honorable foe that a doctor can fight. Even if this death has base allies, hunger, cold, fleas, and lice, it remains a natural death that can be classified according to an official cause. But he won't come to us like that. He will come to us just as he came to those millions who have preceded us here. When he comes, he will almost certainly be stealthy and invisible, almost odorless even. We know that only subterfuge hides death from our view. We know that this death is uniformed because the gas tap is operated by a man in uniform, SS. That is why we yearn so. Looking out at those hazy blue mountains, which are just 22 miles away, but for us, eternally unattainable. That is why I lean so far out of the window toward Block 10, where she is standing. That is why her hands grip the wire mesh on her window so tightly. That is why she rests her head on the wood, because her longing for me must remain unquenched, along with our yearning for those tall, hazy blue mountains. The young grass, the swollen brown chestnut buds, and the radiant sun that was growing more glorious with every passing day seemed to promise new life, but the earth was covered with the chill of death. It was spring 1943. The Germans were deep in Russia, and the fortunes of war had yet to turn. In the West, the Allies still hadn't set foot on the continent. The terror raging over Europe was taking fiercer and fiercer forms. The Jews were the conqueror's playthings. It was a game of cat and mouse. Night after night, motorbikes roared through the streets of Amsterdam, jackboots stamped and orders snarled along the once so peaceful canals. Then later, in Westerbork, the mouse was often released for a moment. People were allowed to move freely around the camp. Packages arrived, and families stayed together. Everyone wrote an obedient, "I am fine" letter to Amsterdam, so that others in turn would also surrender peacefully to the Groene Polizei. In Westerbork, the Jews were given the illusion that everything might not turn out too badly, that although they were now excluded from society, they would one day return from their isolation. "When the war is done and everyone is on the way back home," was the start of a popular song. Not only did they not see their future fate, there were even some who had the courage, or was it blindness, to start a new life, to found a new family. Every day, Dr. Molhuizen came to the camp on behalf of the mayor of the village of Westerbork, and one magnificent morning, from April's quota of 9 fine days, Hans and Friedel appeared before him. They were two idealists. He was 27 and a well-known doctor at the camp. She was just 18. They had got to know each other in the ward where he held sway and she was a nurse. "Because alone we are none, but together we are one," he had written in a poem for her, and that was exactly how they felt. Together they would win through. Maybe they would manage to stay in Vesterbork until the end of the war, and otherwise continue the struggle together in Poland. Because one day the war would end, and a German victory was something nobody believed in. They were together for half a year like this, living in the doctor's room, a cardboard box in the corner of a large barracks with 130 women. They didn't have the room to themselves, but shared it with another doctor and later two other couples. Definitely not the appropriate surroundings for establishing a young married life together. But none of that would have mattered if there hadn't been any transports. 1,000 people every Tuesday morning, men and women, young and old, including babies and even people who were ill. Only a very small number were allowed to stay behind when Hans and the other doctors were able to prove that they were too sick to spend 3 days on a train. Also exempt were those with a privileged status, the baptized, the mixed marriages, Alte Kamp Insassen, who had been interned since 1938, and permanent members of staff, like Hans and Friedel. There was a staff list of 1,000 names, but there was also a steady influx of new arrivals from the cities who needed to be protected, sometimes on German orders, sometimes because they really had been worthy citizens, but mostly because of long-standing connections with the notables on the Jewish Council, or with the Alte Kamp Insassen, who had a firm grip on the key positions in the camp. Then the list of 1,000 would be revised. This was how it came about that an employee of the Jewish Council came to Hans and Friedel on the night of Monday, September 13, 1943, to tell them that they had to get ready for deportation. Hans dressed quickly and made a round of all the authorities, who worked under high pressure on the night before the weekly transport. Dr. Spanier, the head of the hospital, was furious. Hans had been in the camp for a year. He had worked hard. There were many others who had arrived later and never done a thing. But Hans was on the Jewish Council staff list, and if they couldn't keep him on it, the health service couldn't do anything about it either. At 8 o'clock, they were standing with all their belongings next to the train, which ran through the middle of the camp. It was tremendously busy. The camp police and the men of the flying column were carrying baggage to the train, and two wagons were loaded with provisions for the journey. The male nurses from the hospital came trailing up with the patients, mostly elderly, who couldn't walk. There wasn't sufficient reason to let them stay. Next week, they would be no more mobile than they were now. Also present were friends and family who were staying in the camp. They stood behind the cordon, 20 or 30 yards away from the train, often crying more than those who were leaving. At the front and back of the train were carriages with SS guards, but they were very fair and tried to keep people's spirits up, because it was essential to keep the Dutch from finding out how their Jews were really being treated. 10:30, departure. The doors of the goods wagons were bolted on the outside. A last goodbye, a last wave through the hatches in the roof of the wagon, and then they were on their way to Poland, exact destination unknown. Hans and Friedel had been lucky and were in a wagon with only young people, old friends of Friedel's from the Zionist group she had belonged to, friendly and accommodating. Altogether, there were 38 of them. That was relatively few, and with a little reorganization, hanging baggage from the ceiling, there was room for them to all sit down on the floor. The fun and games started during the trip. At the first stop, SS men came into the wagon demanding their cigarettes, and later their watches. The next time it was fountain pens and jewelry. The lads laughed it off, giving them a few loose cigarettes and claiming it was all they had. A lot of them were originally German. They'd had dealings with the SS often enough before. They'd come through it alive then too, and they weren't going to let themselves be bullied around this time either. They weren't given any food in those 3 days, and they never saw the train's provisions again. But that didn't matter. They still had enough with them from Vesterbork. Now and then, a couple of them were allowed to leave the wagon to empty the small and overflowing toilet barrel. They were delighted when they saw signs of bombing raids in the cities, but otherwise the trip was uneventful. On the 3rd day, they found out their destination, Auschwitz. It was just a meaningless word, neither good nor bad. That night, they reached the Auschwitz railway yard. The train stood still for a long time. So long, they grew impatient and wished they would finally get some clarity, that they would finally see what Auschwitz was. The clarity came. At the first sign of dawn, the train started moving for the last time, only to stop again a few minutes later at an embankment in the middle of flat countryside. Standing beside the embankment were groups of 10 to 12 men. They were dressed in blue and white striped clothes with matching hats. A great number of SS men were walking back and forth in an incomprehensible flurry of activity. The moment the train was at a standstill, the costumed men stormed up to the wagons and pulled the doors open. "Throw out the baggage, in front of the wagon, all of it." They were terribly shocked because they realized they had now lost everything. Quickly, they tried to slip the most essential items under their clothes, but the men had already leapt into the wagons and begun tossing out baggage and people. All at once, they were outside, where they hesitated for a moment, but that hesitation didn't last long. SS men came at them from all sides, pushing them toward a road that ran parallel to the railway track, and kicking anyone who didn't move fast enough or hitting them with their sticks, so that everyone hurried as quickly as they possibly could to join the long lines that were forming. Only then did Hans know for certain that the two of them were going to be split up, that men and women were being separated. He hurried to kiss Friedel, "Till we meet again," and then it was over. An officer with a stick was standing at the front of the lines as they slowly marched toward him. He cast a fleeting glance at each person and pointed with his stick, left, right. Old men, invalids, and boys up to about 18 went left. The young and sturdy went right. Hans reached the officer, but wasn't paying attention. He only had eyes for Friedel, who was standing in her line a few yards away and waiting until it was the women's turn. She smiled at him as if to say, "Be patient, it will be all right." That was why he didn't hear the officer, who was a doctor, ask him how old he was. Annoyed at not being answered, the doctor gave Hans a blow with his stick that immediately sent him flying to the left. He was standing among the weak and infirm, old men, a blind man next to him, and a youth on the other side who looked like an imbecile. Hans bit his lip with fear. He realized that only the strong stood any chance of staying alive, and he didn't want to share the fate of the children and the elderly. But it wasn't possible to cross over to the other line, as there were SS men everywhere, guns at the ready. Friedel was directed to the young women. Older women and all women with children were put in a separate line. In this way, 4 lines formed, approximately 150 young women and just as many young men. The other 700 were standing in their own lines on the side of the road. Then the medical officer returned and called out to the elderly men, asking if there were any doctors among them. 4 men leapt forward. The officer turned to Van der Kaus, an elderly Amsterdam GP. "What kind of diseases were there in the camp in Holland?" Van der Kaus hesitated and then told him something about eye diseases. Annoyed, the officer turned away. Hans saw his opportunity. "You probably mean contagious diseases. There were sporadic instances of scarlet fever, which followed a relatively benign course." "Any typhus?" "No, not a single case." "Good. Back in line, all of you." and then, turning to his adjutant, "We'll take him." The adjutant beckoned Hans and took him to the end of the line of young men. He felt that he had escaped a great danger. And sure enough, trucks had arrived in the meantime, and the old men and women were being loaded onto them. He saw now, for the first time, what it was really like under the SS, who began shoving, kicking, and beating people. Many found it difficult to climb up onto the beds of the high trucks, but the Sturmmann sticks guaranteed that all of them did their very best. An elderly woman was bleeding badly from a blow to the head. A few people were left behind. They couldn't possibly get up onto the trucks, and those who tried to come to their aid were chased away with a kick or a snarl. The last truck drove up, and two SS men took an unfortunate old man by the arms and legs and threw him into the back. After that, the women's line began to move. He had lost sight of Friedel, but knew she was there somewhere. When the women were a couple hundred yards away, the men started walking too. The columns were heavily guarded. Soldiers were marching on both sides, guns at the ready. There was one guard for approximately every 10 prisoners. Hans was fairly close to the end of the line. He saw the guards to his left and right signal each other. They looked around for a second. Then the one on his left came up to Hans and asked him for his watch. It was beautiful and had a stopwatch. His mother had given it to him for his doctor's exam. "I need it for my profession. I'm a doctor." A grin passed over the guard's face. "Scheiße, Arzt. A dog, that's what you are. Give me that watch." The man grabbed him by the arm to pull it off. For an instant, Hans tried to resist. "Escape attempt, huh?" the man said, bringing up his rifle. Hans realized how powerless he was and handed over the watch. He had no desire to be shot attempting to escape on his first day in Auschwitz. When they were crossing the railway track, he saw Friedel in the bend of the road. She waved, and he sighed with relief. After the railway line, they passed a barrier with sentry posts that seemed to mark the grounds of the camp proper. There were storage depots for building materials, sheds, and enormous stacks of bricks and timber. There were small trains moved by manpower, wagons dragged by men. Here and there along the road were larger buildings, factories with the hum of machinery coming from the inside, and then more timber, bricks, and sheds. A crane lifting up cement buckets. There was building going on everywhere, and everywhere was alive. But more than cranes and small trains, one saw the men in their thieves' costumes. There was no motorization here. This was the work of thousands, of tens of thousands of hands. Steam is practical. Electricity is efficient, able to be put to work hundreds of miles away. Gasoline is fast and powerful. But people are cheap. That was clear from the hungry eyes. It was clear from the bare chests with ribs standing out like cords holding their bodies together. One saw it from the long lines of men carrying bricks, shuffling along in wooden clogs, or often enough, in bare feet. They trudged on without looking up or around. Their faces remained expressionless. No reaction to the new arrivals. Now and then a tractor pulling wagons full of bricks. The engine thumped slowly. Oil engines. Hans couldn't help but think of the evenings he'd spent on the water, lying back on his boat and listening to the freighters chug by. What life had been like back then. The things it had promised him. He steeled himself. He felt that he couldn't start brooding now. He had to fight. Maybe he could make that old life come back one day. Then they were standing in front of the gate and seeing the camp for the first time. It was made up of large brick barracks. There were about 25 of them. They were two stories high with pitched roofs and small attic windows. The streets between the buildings were well kept. There were pavements with tidy paving stones and small strips of lawn. Everything was clean, well painted, and shining in the bright autumn sun. It could have been a model village, a camp for thousands of laborers working on a great and useful project. Above the gate, in cast iron, the concentration camp slogan, suggestive but dangerous, Arbeit macht frei, a suggestion that was intended to calm the unending multitudes who entered here, here and through many similar gates in other parts of Germany. But it was only an illusion, because this gate was a gate to hell, and instead of work sets you free, it should have said, abandon all hope, ye who enter here. Because the camp was surrounded by electric fences, two rows of concrete posts, neatly whitewashed, 3 yards high, barbed wire on the insulators. The wire looked strong, hard to get through, but what was even worse was invisible. 3,000 volts. With nothing but little red lamps glowing here and there to show that the electricity was on. And every 10 yards, a sign mounted on the fence with a skull and crossbones, and the word stop in German and Polish. Halt, stoi. Still, no barrier is sufficient unless every part of it can be kept under fire. That was why small watchtowers had been built every 100 yards, manned by SS guards with machine guns. No, there was no way out of this place unless by a miracle. The people they encountered in the camp said the same thing, because now that they were inside the wire, they were much less strictly guarded. The SS men had mostly handed over the task to prisoners. Prisoners, to be sure, who looked very different from the thousands at work outside the camp. These ones were wearing striped linen uniforms that were cleaner and well-fitting. Often they were dressed almost elegantly, with black hats and tall boots. On their left arms they wore red bands with numbers on them. These were the Blockälteste, the heads of the various buildings, who organized everything in their block, running their own administration with the help of a clerk and distributing the food. They themselves did not go without. You could tell from their moon-shaped faces. They were all Poles and Reich Germans, citizens of the German Reich. Under the Nazis' Nuremberg race laws, this status was reserved for racially pure Germans. But there were also a few Dutch prisoners around. The SS and the Blockälteste kept them at a distance because the newcomers still had all kinds of valuables on them. Nonetheless, a few managed to come forward. They asked for watches and cigarettes. You're going to lose it all anyway. But most of the new arrivals still didn't believe it and kept everything in their pockets. Hans gave a Dutchman a packet of cigarettes, but an SS man was watching and hit him. The Dutchman had already run off. He'd seen it coming in time. A man appeared, small but with a Herculean build. He was apparently held in great respect. So, lads, when did you leave Westerbork?
3 days ago.
Any news?
Do you already know about the landing in Italy?
Of course, we read the paper. How are things in Holland?
What could they say to that?
They were more interested in hearing how things were here in Auschwitz, what their future would be.
Who are you? Asked one of the newcomers.
Lane Saunders, the boxer. I've been here a year.
The newcomers were momentarily reassured, so it was possible to live here.
Are there still a lot of people from your transport here? Asked Hans, who was already growing skeptical.
Don't ask too many questions. You'll see, the boxer answered. Keep your eyes and ears open and your mouth shut.
But you look fine.
Lane gave a wise smile. That's a boxer for you.
What will we have to do here?
You'll be assigned to the commandos that work outside the camp.
Again, Hans saw the people outside before him, those work machines, lines of them carrying bricks and cement, their expressionless faces
dead eyes and emaciated bodies. What happens to the old people they took away in trucks? Haven't you ever listened to the BBC? Lane asked.
I have.
Well then, you should know. Then Hans knew everything. He thought of Friedel, whose line he had lost sight of. He thought of his mother, his brother, of everyone he had seen leaving for Auschwitz. He thought of his studies, his practice, his ambitions. He thought once again of Friedel and their plans for the future. They were the thoughts of someone who was convinced he was going to die. And yet doubts were already appearing. Maybe he would be lucky. Maybe. He was a doctor. No, he didn't dare hope, but he had to. He couldn't believe that he would die here, but he couldn't believe in life anymore either. A snarl brought him back to his senses.
Aufgehen!
They walked down Lagerstrasse between the big blocks. There were a lot of people out on the streets. Glass plates were mounted over the doors of some of the blocks. Häftlingskrankenbau, interne Abteilung, Eintritt verboten. Sitting in front of the hospital door were men in white suits with red stripes on the backs of their coats and along the seams of their trousers. They looked fit and healthy and must have been the doctors. These men hardly glanced at the new arrivals, but Hans saw that their lack of interest wasn't the same as the indifference of the thousands outside. With all those work slaves, it had been the exhaustion, the deep despondency that had prevented any mental effort. With these handsome men, it was a kind of arrogance. After all, they were privileged, the camp prominents. And what were they, the newcomers? Everyone was free to abuse and ridicule them. They arrived at Block 26, the Effektenkammer. Lane explained what that meant. It was here that the prisoners' personal effects, clothes, and other valuables were stored. Above the windows, you could see long lines of paper bags, each containing the property of one man. If someone was going to be released from the camp, he'd get it all back. Their clothes would not be stored. Jews were never released. There weren't any legal proceedings involving them. As they hadn't been sentenced to any punishment, they couldn't be freed. Sure enough, between blocks 26 and 27, they were ordered to undress. All of their clothes and everything they had on them was loaded onto a wagon. They were only allowed to keep a leather belt and a handkerchief. Hans tried to hold on to a few of his best instruments, but they were on to him in no time. A scrawny man with a band on his left arm, Lagerfriseur, was checking everyone. Those who had tried to keep something back had to surrender it after all and got a blow for good measure. Hans asked if he could keep his instruments. The man grinned and pocketed the lot. There they stood. Now they had lost everything. The process had been slow, but now it was complete. Had not Schmidt, the Commissioner General for Public Security in the Netherlands and Reuter's representative for Jewish affairs once said, "The Jews will return to the land they came from as naked as when they arrived here"? Schmidt had not gone into detail about when those Jews had come, in the 16th and 17th centuries, and that they hadn't really arrived naked, but had often brought great treasures with them from the countries that had expelled them. Nor did he mention the historic rights of Dutch Jews, granted to them long ago by decree of William of Orange. But how could he have spoken of the work of a Dutch hero who had fought for freedom? You couldn't expect that from heroes of Nazi oppression, who would not die with a patriotic prayer on their lips, but take to their heels to try to save their own skin. Hans consoled himself with that thought. There was no doubt that he was in a bad position, but still, his fate was dark, theirs was certain. They would definitely fall, and then, of all their victories, only one would be left. Their victory over the Jews. slowly but surely, the Dutch Jews had been pushed toward their ruin. 1940, all Jews sacked from public office. 1941, banned from practicing liberal professions, banned from using public transport, banned from shopkeeping, banned from theaters and parks, sport, and everything that makes life beautiful. Permitted capital capped at 10,000 guilders, later 250 guilders. 1942, start of deportation, the ban on life itself. Slowly, because the Dutch would not have tolerated their Jews being exterminated at a time when the terror in Holland still hadn't taken hold. Now they were standing stark naked in the burning sun, which beat down on their bodies for hours while the rituals to turn them into Häftlinge were completed. Standing behind a long bench were six barbers who cut off their hair and shaved their heads and bodies. They didn't ask if Sir would care for some powder or a scalp massage. They were rough, annoyed at having so much work to do on a hot afternoon. With their blunt razors, they tore out the hair more than shaving it off, and they manhandled and sometimes hit anybody who didn't turn and twist enough to let them get everywhere easily. When the barber had finished, you got a note with a number to take to the tattooist. Hans got 150822. He just smiled scornfully as the number was jabbed into the skin of his arm. Now he was no longer Dr. Van Damme. He was Häftling number 150822. What did he care? As long as he could one day become Dr. Van Damme again. If he could only become Dr. Van Damme again. And then that thought was there again, rolling back and forth in his head like an enormous ball and making a sound like a gramophone spinning out of control, until a thump from behind brought him back to his senses. They went into the washroom, about 50 at a time. Inside were rows of showers next to each other. Three men had to share each shower, which gave a trickle of lukewarm water. Too cold to soak off the dust and summer sweat, too hot to freshen up. Then a man wearing big rubber gloves came and smeared stinking disinfectant under their arms and over their pubic area with a single swipe. After they had been sprayed with a flit gun, they were rein, which was a far cry from what we would call clean. They were still half wet and sticky from sweat and disinfectant. Their skin was burning, and the nicks and scrapes from being shaved smarted, but at least they were free of lice and fleas. It was not easy to quickly find something that fitted in the large piles of clothing. The corridor of the Bekleidungskammer, as Block 27 was called, was dark when you came in from the bright sunlight, and you had no idea what to actually take. You were pushed, shoved, and yelled at, and if that didn't make you go fast enough, they hit you until you had gathered up some clothes. An undershirt, a coat, and a pair of linen trousers, a hat and a pair of wooden shoes or sandals. They weren't given enough time to find the right sizes and looked like clowns in their convict uniforms. One man's calves were showing. Another was stumbling over his trousers. One man was missing one of his coat sleeves. Another had to roll his up. But all of the clothes had one thing in common. They were all equally dirty and patched, cobbled together from pieces of blue and white striped material. Now dressed, they were standing in front of the block again. The day was almost over, but the heat of late summer was still weighing heavily on the camp. They were hungry and thirsty, but no one was brave enough to ask for anything. They waited for another hour in Birkenallee, the street that ran behind the blocks. Sitting on the edges of the pavement and on the benches by the strips of lawn, or simply lying stretched out on the street, exhausted and overcome by the misery they had been plunged into. Registration tables had been set up in the street. All conceivable facts, personal or otherwise, were noted down. Professional and other characteristics, particularly diseases, tuberculosis, venereal diseases, and once again the familiar questions about nationality and the number of Jewish grandparents. Hans was talking to Eli Polak, a fellow doctor. Eli was a broken man. He had seen his wife when the trucks were at the train. She had fainted, and they had thrown her onto the back of a truck, followed by their child. "I'll never see them again." Hans felt incapable of consoling him. He couldn't lie. "You don't know that," he answered, but with little conviction. "Have you heard what happens in Birkenau?" "What's Birkenau?" Hans asked. "Birkenau is an enormous camp," Eli answered. "It's part of the whole Auschwitz complex. On arrival, they tell all the old people and all the children they have to shower and take them into a big room. In reality, they gas them. Then they burn the bodies." "But it won't be like that with all of them," Hans said, forcing himself to comfort him. Then the soup arrived, 3 kettles. Everyone was supposed to get 1 liter. They queued up in a long line. A few of the pushiest helped dole it out. They ate from large metal bowls, dented, with bare patches in the enamel. As there weren't enough bowls to go round, they put 2 liters in each bowl and you had to share it with someone. There were also spoons, about 20. Those who didn't get a spoon had to drink from the bowl. That wasn't difficult, the soup was only thin. It had the odd hard bit floating in it, and there were discussions as to whether they were beech or elm leaves. But none of that mattered. Most of them were still well-nourished, and then it doesn't make much difference whether you get 1 liter of hot water or 1 liter of food in your stomach. Suddenly, they were being hurried up. "Quick, it's almost roll call!" They slurped down the hot soup as fast as they could and were taken to a large wooden warehouse that had been built between 2 blocks. It was a laundry. In one half, clothes were being washed in big cauldrons. In the other, there were showers. Hans counted 144. Along the walls were benches where people could get undressed. They sat on the benches and waited. They heard that after the roll call, which was held outside at that time, they would be traveling on to Buna. The man from the administration who told them was bombarded with questions. "What is that, Buna? Is it good there? Do you get soup like this there, too?" He said it was all right. You had to work in a synthetic rubber factory. The food was good there because you were in the service of an industrial concern. The man gave a knowing smile. Hans discovered a Belgian. "Have you been here long?" "A year." "Is it possible to stick it out?" "Sometimes, if you're lucky and get into a good commando." "What's a good commando?" "The laundry or the hospital or something like that. Almost all of the commandos that stay in the camp in the daytime are good. The food commandos, too. But as a Jew, you don't stand a chance of them." "I'm a doctor. Could I get into the hospital?"
"Didn't you tell them you were a doctor?"
"Yes, but they brushed me off."
"Where do they take the women?"
"The women from this transport were brought into the camp. There's a women's block here where they do all kinds of experiments." Hans's heart stood still. Friedel, here in this camp, experiments. What could that mean? He told the Belgian about Friedel and asked him if he would take a message to her, as he himself would be leaving for Buna. The Belgian said it was extremely difficult because it was very dangerous to go near the women's block. Just then, an SS man came in. They all jumped up as they had been taught. He asked the big question. "Are there any doctors here?" 3 of them leapt forward, Hans, Eli Polak, and a young fellow they didn't know. The SS men asked how long they had been practicing medicine. The young chap turned out to be a junior doctor. Eli had been a GP for 8 years. The SS man sent Eli back to the others. You're going to Buna with them.
He took Hans and the younger man away with him.
They walked through the camp, past all the buildings, and arrived at Block 28, where they had to wait in the corridor. It was a long concrete corridor with whitewashed walls and doors on both sides. On the doors were signs: Ambulanz, Schreibstube, Operationssaal, Hals-Nasen-Ohrenarzt, Röntgenraum, and many others. Halfway along the corridor were concrete stairs up to the first floor. After a couple of minutes, a man in a white suit arrived. He took them to the end of the corridor. Aufnahme was written on the frosted glass door. It was a large room, more like a ward, and only half filled with bunks. In the other half, there were a few benches, scales, and a large table covered with books and documents. This was where everyone who was admitted to the hospital registered, either as a patient or a member of staff. They were met by a small, fat Pole. He snarled at them, wanting to know why they looked so filthy, told them to get completely undressed, and pointed out a bed. The beds were triple bunks. Hans lay naked under two thin blankets on the top bunk. He tried to roll himself up a little in the blankets because the straw in the mattress itched. Just after he had lain down, a man clambered up to his bed. He was about 30, with a round face and a pair of glasses perched jauntily on his nose. "What's your name?" he asked. "Are you a doctor?"
"Yes, I'm Van Damme. And you?"
"De Hond. I've been here for 3 weeks now. I saw the Lagerarzt last week. He took me on, and now I'm on the Pfleger reserve list."
"Where did you study?" Hans asked.
"In Utrecht. I was at the children's hospital."
"What kind of work do you do here?"
"Oh, all kinds. They come and get you for all sorts of odd jobs all day long. You'll see, it's filthy work with cadavers and so on. Don't you have any clothes?"
No, Hans didn't have any. They would need to be organized the next day. De Hond would help him.
"Do you know anything about the women's block here?"
"Oh," De Hond replied, clearly nervous.
"Yes, that's Block 10. My wife's there. She's a doctor as well. She arrived there 3 weeks ago."
Hans was glad to hear there was a Dutch doctor there. He told De Hond about Friedel and that she too had been taken to Block 10.
"Hmm," said De Hond. "We'll have to see what can be done for her."
"What do you mean?"
"Well, Samuel, the professor who works there, promised me he won't take my wife because she's a doctor. Maybe he'll be willing to bend the rules for a doctor's wife, too."
"What do they do with those women?"
"You'll have to ask Samuel that yourself. He comes here every day."
"Can I see my wife?"
"That's very difficult. If they catch you, they'll put you in the bunker, in the prison, and then you can count yourself lucky if you get off with 25.
"What do you mean, 25?
"That's the standard punishment. 25 strokes on the backside."
Hans smiled. Things like that didn't scare him. You just had to make sure they didn't catch you. And anyway, it would be worth it to see Friedel.
De Hond promised to take him with him the next evening. Then it was 9 o'clock, and lights off. But it wasn't dark in the ward. Block 28 was the last block in the row, and admissions was on the side, near the fence. The lights along the wire were on, and there were brighter lights on every second concrete post. Anything that came near the wire would be well lit. It was an impressive sight, those long lines of bright lights with red warning lights between them. They shone into the room, illuminating the patients who had been allocated beds in admissions before being presented to the Lagerarzt the next day.
Hans didn't want to see the light anymore. It frightened him. He closed his eyes, but kept opening them again for another look, as if forcing himself to take in the painful reality. He grew nervous and turned from side to side, but the light pursued him. He pulled the blankets up over his head, but couldn't block it out. It shone through everywhere. There was no escaping it. He was in a Konzentrationslager. Whether you turned your head away or shrank back under the blankets, that awareness remained. No matter what you tried to think, that thought dominated everything, just as the lights on the wire followed you wherever you looked. Hans wept. He wasn't crying out of anger like he had as a boy when he hadn't got his way about something. This was a quiet weeping that seemed to rise up by itself. There was no storm inside him. He was simply overflowing with sorrow, and the tears flowed automatically. But fortunately, he was tired, dead tired. He didn't even wipe away his tears. He no longer felt that he was crying, and slowly the flame of his consciousness went out. In concentration camps, people experience many happy hours every day. The lights are turned off for them, the electric current is shut down, and the wire is cut. The soul can free itself from the exhausted and tormented body. In the realm the Häftling enters at night, there are no SS men, no Blockälteste, and no Kapos. There is only one master, the great longing. There is only one law, freedom. Life is a cycle made up of two periods, from the morning gong to the night gong, and from the night gong to the morning gong. When the morning gong sounds, the senses come to life, and the soul is enchained. Paradise is over. Half an hour after the gong, the patients began arriving. Hans was able to watch the whole process from his bed. The men undressed outside, tied their clothes up in a bundle with the number on the jacket visible on top, then entered the block naked. In the washroom, they were all washed, and their numbers were written on their chests to make sure the Lagerarzt didn't waste any of his valuable time checking who was who. From the washroom, they went back to admissions, where they were registered and could start waiting. There were approximately 60 of them. They were all washed and registered by 7, but the Lagerarzt didn't arrive until about 10. Still, nobody was bored. Most of the men were glad to be able to stay away from work for a day. Many were too ill to be bored. They were able to sit on the few benches, and otherwise nobody paid any attention to them. A number of them were in pain or running a fever, but nobody was allowed to give them anything or help them until they had seen the Lagerarzt. At 9:30, Hans and von Leer, the junior doctor, had to get up. They too were going to be presented to the Lagerarzt. It was a strange way to appear before your future boss, but on the other hand, it was perhaps better to be introduced naked than in one of those filthy uniforms. Then the call sounded in the corridor.
Arztvormelder, antreten!
The Reich Germans went first. They were prisoners too, but in this camp, with mostly Polish and Jewish inmates, they occupied a special position. After the Germans, the Poles and other Aryans, the Jews came last. They went through the corridor, all trotting in line to outpatients, which turned out to be in quite a good state. Running through the middle of the room was a metal bar at about knee height, which the patients had to stand behind. Generally, nurses stood on the other side, in front of large tables with wound dressing materials, while the clerks sat behind a glass wall in the office, where all those who had ever visited the outpatients' clinic were listed in a card index system. This time, there were no patients and no nurses, only the Lagerarzt with another member of the SS, an Unterscharführer, and 2 Polish prisoners, the Polish Lagerältester, who was responsible for all prisoner doctors, and the admissions doctor. The Poles had examined all those who had to see the SS doctor the previous evening and were there to present them to him now. Not that the presentations amounted to much. There were no explanations, no discussions, no further examinations. Quick,
Quick, the Obersturmführer didn't have any time. He never had any time. A diagnosis read off a card, a fleeting glance at the patient, and he was ready with his answer. Admission or Blockschonung. In the latter case, the sick prisoner received an exemption from work for a certain number of days and could stay in the barracks. This was for those who didn't need to be admitted to hospital but still couldn't work due to things like injuries to their fingers or boils on their legs. The sick Jews, however, usually needed to be admitted because their general condition was extremely poor. These were the people who worked in the harshest commandos, never received packages, and were always cheated the most when the Blockältesten were distributing food in the barracks. Admission, admission, Blockschonung, admission. They got through the whole line in a few minutes, and only the two Dutchmen were left. Doctors arrived on transport yesterday, the Polish doctor reported. The Lagerarzt nodded. A sign. Then it was done. They raced back to the admissions ward and had to get back into bed. Hans was happy. After all, this was his chance. Life in the hospital would be very different from outside on those building sites. Nurses took the patients who had been admitted to the various blocks: surgery, internal diseases, infectious diseases. The others went outside to get dressed. Those who had Blockschonung were given a note for their block clerk. De Hond came to fetch the two Dutchmen and took them outside. The clothes of the people who had been admitted to hospital were still lying there. A few nurses were already untying the bundles and removing anything of value from the pockets. Any clothes that were good and intact were laid to one side. The rest went on a barrow, from which the two young men were allowed to pick something out. Afterward, they were somewhat bearably dressed. They even had leather shoes, very down at heel, true, but easier on the feet than wooden sandals. But now that they were dressed, they could also work, and were immediately claimed for a job. They had to take the barrow of clothes to disinfection. The capo from disinfection was standing at the door. He was the absolute ruler over the 12 men who worked in his wooden outbuilding. When the two novices approached, he gave a sarcastic bow. Two grand gentlemen. And where are the gentlemen from? Van Leer tried to be polite. We come from Holland, sir. The capo laughed. Then you'll soon be dead. The Dutch all drop dead here in a couple of weeks. You're too delicate. You can't work. Hans shrugged as if to say, we'll see. Just then the big steam boiler opened and the trolley with disinfected clothes came rolling out. Go on, unload it. They unloaded it. It was hot, terribly hot. The clothes were still at boiling point. Steam was billowing up everywhere. They burnt their hands and choked in the scalding air. Within seconds, they were dripping with sweat. But the capo kept harassing them, and when they stopped to gasp for air, he shoved them and snarled, "Faster, you idiots!" After they'd pulled all of the clothes out of the boiler, Hans was reeling as he tried to catch his breath in front of the small building. Suddenly, someone gave him a friendly pat on the shoulder. It was a Polish Jew, one of the lads working in disinfection. Our capo's a sterling fellow, isn't he? Hans gave him an uncomprehending look. Well, he was joking with you, but you don't know what the Lager really means. Have you been here long, then? The Pole pointed at the number on his chest. 62,000-something. I've been here 1.5 years now. I went through the hard times. Now it's like a sanatorium. They hardly ever hit you, and if you don't turn into a Musulman, you're in no danger at all. What do you mean? What's a Musulman? You really are new, aren't you? Have you heard of those people who go to Mecca on pilgrimage, emaciated, completely starved, skin and bones, characters like Gandhi? They're Musulmen.
Hans didn't understand. What do they do with them? They can't work anymore. They go to the crematorium. It used to be different. I was working in Birkenau. Back then, when the commandos turned out and the capo reported, Roadworks Commando, 270 men, the SS at the gate said, that's 40 too many. Then the SS guard, who was leading the commando and the capos, would make sure to beat 40 men to death that day. Marching back that night, we'd smell our mates who had been superfluous in the morning roasting. They didn't care if they were Musulmen or not. Thousands died like that, and anyone who was lucky enough to come through it croaked some other way. Picture it, 5 miles out in the morning and 5 back at night, standing in water all day, scooping up gravel, sometimes up to your ankles, sometimes up to your waist. In winter, we'd often come back with clothes frozen solid and as hard as a plank. And the beatings. Don't think you could lean on your shovel, not for a second. There'd be an SS man there right away who knew what to do with you. Look. He showed Hans his leg, a big scar, and his left hand, 2 fingers missing. Smashed to a pulp. My mate was smoking a cigarette on the job. I asked him for a drag. Just when he was about to pass me the cigarette, the guard came. He swung at me with the butt of his rifle. I deflected it, and my hand got caught between the rifle butt and a wall. There was a second blow for my friend. That evening, we carried him back to the camp unconscious. We might have been able to save him, but it was a long roll call that night, a good 3 hours, and he had to lie there all that time. Couldn't you get him any help? It was roll call, and the number had to be right. No matter what state you were in, you had to be counted. Jacques, the Polish Jew, was quiet for a moment, staring at the stumps on his left hand. Hans looked around and was suddenly shocked. Diagonally across from disinfection, there was a block with wire mesh on the windows, and behind that wire he could see women. Yes, there was a sign too, block 10. So this was the women's block. Jacques saw the surprise on his face. What do you see? Hans hesitated. I think that's where my wife is. Jacques could hardly believe it. Your wife arrived yesterday too? Man, you really are a lucky dog. Could I see her? In the evening. It's risky. You have to be prepared for that. The Pfleger who had accompanied them with the clothes came over. Back to the block. The rest of the day passed with bustling inactivity. There was always a loose straw to be found on one of the beds. There was always a window with a smudge on it. Grab a piece of scrap paper and clean it. It was boring, but Hans didn't complain. Instead, he thought of the work machines outside. Every day you put behind you unscathed in here was one day closer to the end. That was what Kalkar said, too. Kalkar was a doctor from The Hague. Hans had seen him now and then at the home of relatives who had him as their GP. Now he was working in Block 21, the surgical block. He had dropped by to see which new Dutchman had arrived. It's a rude awakening, all right, he told Hans and Van Leer. Not what we expected. How long have you been here? 3 weeks now. I was here in admissions for the first fortnight. Then they assigned me to Block 21. Do you assist the surgeons? Kalker burst out laughing. Yes, after studying the anatomical topography of the lavatory construction, I've moved on to cleaning work. You have no idea how complicated and fascinating it is. You mop the floors 4 times a day and scrub the toilet bowls with sand every other day. My lavatories are a feast for the eyes. I have 2, one for patients, with 12 bowls in 2 rows, and one with a row of 6 for staff. In the small lavatory, there is a closed-off cubicle for the camp's leading lights, the Block-L-Tester and the Lager-L-Tester, and rumor has it that it's sometimes even used by the Lager-Arzt.
but that honor hasn't been granted me just yet. In any case, he's only in the camp for half an hour each day, and I'm sure he's quite capable of holding it in for that long. It would really be too much for him to have to sit down on a toilet that Häftlinge have sat on beforehand. Hans was enjoying the cheerful tone Kalker had adopted for his story. "Do you get enough to eat?" he asked. "Well, it's all right. There's usually seconds of the soup, so I get 1.5 liters. And once you've been officially assigned somewhere, you get extra bread twice a week." "How much exactly?"